Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit credit union supporting the community through partnerships like the Hands-On Children's Museum's Inspired Learning for All initiative, which brings expanded programming and greater access to this youth museum on Olympia's waterfront. More information at WSECU.org.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme today is first half favorites. We're revisiting some hidden places and some larger-than-life personalities from the first half of 2017. There's a nondescript gray building off of I-90 in Issaquah. And from the edge of the parking lot, there's a 15-foot sculpture of an upright bass. Inside Suite 100, a handful of children are practicing the Suzuki method of learning the violin. The students start as young as age 3 or 4, and first they learn how to play. And then they learn how to read music. All of the violins the kids are playing in this room are different. In fact, every violin in the world feels different and makes its own unique sound. 88.5's Ed Ronco takes us inside of Hammond Ashley violins to find out why each instrument is so different. And the answer, it's one thing.
The wood.
The wood is everything in the timbre of the instrument.
That is Bryce Van Paris, general manager at Hammond Ashley Violins.
Well, it's always a maple back and a spruce top, but it's about where that wood grows and at what altitude that produces a certain timbre or tone.
And it was the need for quality wood that grew this company. That and the Cold War. We'll explain in a second. Hammond Ashley is named for its owner, first name Hammond, last name Ashley, and he started this business in the 1960s after he retired from Boeing.
He was an engineer, and then he met other woodworkers who, at the time in the 70s, started experimenting with sound testing these music acoustic instruments and expanding their palette and trying different woods, like local Northwest woods were being popular because the traditional violin wood was stuck in the Eastern Bloc.
Behind the Iron Curtain, it was hard to get. So the company made violins with Northwest wood, first in the Des Moines area and now in Issaquah. The drive out here along I-90 goes from office parks and malls to trees and trees and trees. And nestled in those trees is Hammond Ashley's building. Lessons at one end, a retail shop at the other, and in between, luthiers. That's what you call people who build and repair stringed instruments, luthiers. This workspace looks like a field hospital. There are big operating tables in the middle where basses and cellos can be placed on their backs. Off to the side, workbenches, like beds in an emergency room. At one of those benches, Rick Wakeland is putting new horsehair on a bow.
You're just combing it out there.
Combing out, gathering it together, and then wrapping the wire.
He's worked here for 11 years, after 20 working in instrument repair.
And you catch me on a day when my voice is going.
Sorry.
At the moment, he's hunched over a bow and warmly dressed in a black and white flannel shirt. He has long gray hair and a salt and pepper beard, all beneath a cabbie hat. He also has a visor with a magnifying lens on it and the word Rick's written across the top. Those magnifying lenses come in handy. Many parts of the bow are absolutely minute. Rick shows me a teeny little plug that goes into the tip of the bow to hold the horsehair in place. One end of it is perfectly concave, and it's really hard to see because it is sitting on the end of his finger, no bigger than a pencil eraser.
And I have to hand carve each one of these plugs.
And that is a tiny little...
Yep, small plug that fits in the mortise and the tip of the bow.
And you hand carved it. I mean, it looks like it would sit nicely on top of a dime. It's that small.
It's smaller than a dime.
A dime would look like a dinner plate underneath mm-hmm. that.
Yes. Well, it slides right in.
The industry has changed a lot. Stores have come and gone. But one thing that hasn't changed, really, is how the work is done. Still by hand, still meticulously, and in the case of the bows, still using real horsehair. It is hanging behind Rick on the wall in what look like giant ponytails. There's some blonde, some black horsehair. Some of it is premium for expensive customer instruments, and some of it is called standard, which is used mostly for rental and school violin bows. Rick points to a bow that costs about $100, and then...
This one I'm going to be working on and restoring, and have been, is $2,700.
For the bow?
For the bow.
Why?
It's the wood. That's the type of wood.
Yeah.
And most of it is the way it reacts and plays.
I hope you'll forgive that question. I don't mean to be denigrating or anything. No. I'm curious what changes the value.
I'm a fiddle player, so most of them feel the same in my hands as, a $100 bow feel pretty close to what a $1,000 bow is. My hands are too heavy.
As we're talking, a violin comes in that needs to be restrung. The customer is waiting up front, and so Rick puts down the bow and gets to work. Rick says he does this work because he's good at it. It is art, and it is science and craftsmanship, and it is taking broken bows and turning them, once again, into something people can make music with. Hammond Ashley, who started this company in the 60s after his retirement, worked another 30 years with violins until his death in 1993 at age 91. And working that long is not unusual, says Bryce Van Paris, the general manager we met earlier.
In this industry, people work until they can't drag their butt to work anymore. There's plenty of people in their 80s and 90s, and just like musicians. They just go until they just physically can't keep up because we love it. We can't do anything else.
That was 88.5's Ed Ronco telling us that story. It originally came from our show that celebrated Sound Effect's 100th episode, Sweet 100. And this is not a suite that you eat. It's one that you work in, office suites with the same address, 100. Again, today on Sound Effect, we are revisiting some of the characters we've met and the places we've been to this first part of 2017. We'll hang out with a legendary black-owned beauty salon surviving in a quickly changing Seattle. We'll find out how a methadone clinic in Tacoma, how it works. And we'll meet one person whose life depends on this place. And we'll go on an adventure from Yemen to Seattle. The precious cargo on this trip is, of course, coffee. This next story comes from a show that we did about heartbreak. And if you're feeling a little too happy and this emotional state bothers you and has you feeling weird, go back and listen to that entire episode. A famous video producer and photographer, Marcus Haney, has captured some really big names on film. Elton John, Coldplay. In 2014, Marcus was asked to produce a music video for a British band called Bear's Den. His idea was to film his younger brother, Turner Haney, and his friends. They were all students at Seattle Pacific University. Marcus wanted to capture youth on the brink of adulthood. But on June 5th, 2014, the day the filming was set to begin, something horrible happened on SPU's campus. Aaron Ybarra walked onto campus with a shotgun and opened fire. Two people were injured. One was killed. He was 19-year-old Paul Lee. He was a freshman. Paul was Turner's friend. Turner Haney and his friend Katie Reagan, who was also going to be in the video, sat down with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad. Turner says that the shooting happened as he was picking up his brother Marcus, the photographer, at the airport.
I had to make a stop in Georgetown on the way back to do some repairs on my car. And that's when I was in the waiting room of the auto body place. There's another guy just flipping through the channels and flipped past the news channel and I saw my school. So I told him to go back, and that's where I started knowing what was going on.
I was working at a retail spot downtown, and I overheard a woman in the store talking on the phone with somebody. I couldn't really, hear the specifics, but I basically heard, they think there was an, armed person on campus. There were shots fired. We don't really know what else is happening. And at that point, I automatically knew, somehow that someone that I knew was affected, that something was going down at my school.
I came back and just looked for my friends and, the same friends that we were doing this video with. It was clear that nobody knew anything. We were kind of all just trying to get in touch with whoever we knew.
There were just floods of phone calls and everyone just trying to keep tabs on everyone that they could immediately think of, making sure that they would answer their phone or that, you know, that they were safe.
We still didn't know who had been injured. So as the night progressed, like, there started becoming this conversation forming on my floor in the residence hall. There's one kid that nobody had been able to get in touch with yet. And my roommate pulled me aside, and he was going to be a residence advisor the next year, and so he was kind of privy to this information. He said, "Keep this down, but it's looking like it may be Paul." Once it got later into the night and we couldn't hear from Paul, a few people pulled their mattresses out and were waiting by the elevator for him. And pretty soon after that, everybody's mattress was out.
It's a really small school. Like, if there was, you know, even one person that got injured, you probably know them, or you know of them, or you know someone that knows them really closely. And so it was just a lot of trying to figure that out and just trying not to go insane while you're doing it.
When did you find out that Paul had been killed?
It was the next day.
I think, yeah, because there were two other students that were in the hospital, and so they didn't release any of the three names until, I think, later the next day.
We were just overloaded, not really knowing how to feel. It didn't feel real.
It was just like, let's all just try to get through it. Like, that's all anyone could really handle at that moment.
Can you tell me about Paul? What was he like?
He was hilarious. He was a riot. he was somebody that everybody just really enjoyed being around. He dressed a little thuggy, but he was just the nicest guy. He was always the life of the party. He's a great dancer. He loved to dance.
Even if you didn't know Paul, you knew that he danced.
Yeah.
And you had probably seen a video of him dancing at some point.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How did you guys sort of cope initially?
We wanted to be together. It was the cast of this music video, but it was the cast because we were close friends. It just kind of happened to be that we all knew Paul. So we just kind of needed each other and just needed to be together.
So when did the conversation happen with your brother about whether or not you guys were going to still do this?
I think I brought that up the day after the shooting, you know, in the context of maybe doing it, but doing it for Paul. This is, you know, a unique situation, and right now we have the platform to do something significant and maybe show the public an intimate view of what a school shooting looks like from the inside.
And, I mean, Marcus was really great about it. We all sat down the night after the shooting, and he's like, "Hey, guys, like, this is probably the worst situation that is, or the worst thing that's happened to a lot of you. So if you're out, no hard feelings. But if you want to do this, it's going to be awesome. And it's going to be one of the worst weeks of your life, but we're going to try to make something good out of it."
That was when we really started listening to the song and listening to the lyrics. The name of the song is Elysium, and it's by Bear's Den. The opening lyrics are, "Brother, do you believe in an afterlife?
Brother, do you believe in an afterlife where our souls will both collide in some great Elysium way up in the sky?"
That was another reason that we decided to do this video, was that somehow it became so relevant and so applicable to the situation.
For the next 3 days, it was on, and that was what we were listening to, and that was kind of a way to, I don't know how it happened, but that song was meant for that scenario, and just the fact that we got to experience it and that we got to, you know, listen to that song and really process through it, I think was just incredible.
Every page I turn, I only find myself feeling.
What happened next?
Marcus would put us in situations and just let us do what we were going to do, except now there was this element of us doing it for a purpose. What came through was this video of, you know, you can see us kind of needing each other there. Just like another dimension to what it would have been. There's this close group of friends that's loyal to each other, but now they need each other.
Is there a moment in this video that's personal to you or stands out to you?
There's like one little scene. We are all inside one of our friends' houses and we are kind of dancing around and we are playing. And we were flipping through the TV and we found a news station that was playing footage from our school that had happened 2 days before. And we all just kind of stopped and, you know, stopped mid-dance move, you know, mid-drink, whatever, and just kind of like stared at the TV for, you know, a solid 5 minutes, just in complete silence. And I look over to my friend Natalie, who's in the video, and we both just start crying and I hug her. And that's kind of like the turning point of the whole video, where it kind of goes into the grieving and the sadness that we were all feeling. You know, I have that clip in my brain and I, you know, play it back very regularly. And it was just this horrible kind of realization that, like, yep, this still happened. This wasn't a dream. Like, this is actually going on.
You know, there were times where, you know, crying just didn't fit anymore. And so we'd just be talking about Paul and just laughing, laughing our ass off at the shit that he pulled.
One of the scenes that sort of jumps out to me in this video, too, is when you put a sweatshirt down.
Mm-hmm. I made a stencil that said, "Dance, Paul," and spray painted it white on the back of the sweatshirt. And the end scene where we're walking and we end up at the memorial and the flowers and the candles and the notes with people still all around it, just laying that down and leaving that for Paul. That was something, you know, I was going to do regardless. I'm glad that I just barely had enough time to make it a part of the video.
You both said that, you know, if you guys were going to do this, you wanted to do it for Paul. Was that successful?
Yes. The biggest thing for me was, this is probably going to reach Paul's family, Paul's brother. How are they going to view this? And I never felt fully at peace about the video until over a year later. My brother forwarded me an email that he got from Paul's brother. And that was the point that justified it all for me. I don't care what people on YouTube think, or whether they think it's a good video, or whether they think we're hipster kids taking advantage of a situation. If Paul's brother thanked us for the video, that's what I was looking for. Just hold out against the night.
Guard your hope with your life. That was Turner Haney and Katie Reagan talking to Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestad. Welcome back. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm your host, Jennifer Wing, and today we're listening to some of our favorite stories that we've done so far in 2017. Back in February, we handed the show over to the women of Hella Black, Hella Seattle. It's a podcast, and if you haven't checked it out yet, you should. It shines a light on people of color in the Seattle area. And one of them is Dee Charlene Williams. She's 73 years old. She owns a salon on Madison Avenue, where Seattle's First Hill neighborhood and the Central District meet. And she's been here for decades. Today, the small Black-owned businesses around her, they're being replaced by new apartments and shops. Dee Charlene says her salon on the corner of 22nd and Madison is not going anywhere. Hella Black, Hella Seattle co-host Jasmine Jackson takes us inside.
We're in DeCharlene's salon, and it is absolutely like being in a time capsule all the way back to the 60s. It's amazing. It's like a museum. There are beautiful hats that she's designed. There are furs. There are tons of different plaques and pictures. There's one that says, this is to certify that the NAACP has successfully enrolled or more new members in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in the 1975 campaign. I mean, it's so awesome. So we're going to go sit down and talk to DeCharlene about hair, politics, and the Central District. I actually grew up around the corner from here on 20th and Denny. Mm-hmm. I remember when Dino's was here and Madison Plaza and Planned Parenthood was over here and Chester Dorsey's. You were the first woman that ever did my hair.
Mm-hmm. Is that good?
Yes, it was amazing. You did when I was 7. It was over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had these big, beautiful bouncy curls, and I always admired you, DeCharlene.
Mm-hmm. I've been here for 48 years.
That's amazing.
And I love my work. I love hairdressing. Yes. I've always wanted to be a hairdresser. And I loved it. I love it from age 4.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to be a hairdresser and a dress designer.
Yes.
So this is my dream. My business is my dream.
Yes.
And that's why I tell people to plan their work and work their plan. And you put it out on paper so you see what you want to do. It's like a roadmap for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I've been in business for 55 years.
So it has not always been easy for DeCharlene having her salon in that location. You know, today developers like to get a hold of her property, but crime has also been a problem for her over the years. People have tried to break in every way possible, either to steal or by accident. The beauty shop is on a corner and cars have crashed into the front.
Yeah, I've been through a lot here. I used to have glass doors. Remember the glass doors
yes.
I used to have?
Mm-hmm.
They ran a car through here.
Oh, my gosh.
And broke all my glass doors out. And I had to have these doors special made. Hollow core doors, heavy, they're double to keep them
wow.
out of here.
Wow.
Big, heavy doors, that's why they're heavy, to keep them out. They used to chop holes in my roof.
Wow.
And I've been through a lot here on
yeah.
this corner.
Yeah. What has kept you here?
God.
Yeah.
You see, God gave me this building, mm-hmm. told me to keep it, and he wanted me to be an image, an icon for the people.
Absolutely.
And show them how to do a successful business, and he wanted me to be able to help people. And then they had a lot of young girls on the street, and they were prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted them off the streets to be women, feminine women, no
yes.
prostitutes.
Yes.
And that's my motto is I dream to make all women beautiful. And that's what I'm talking about, in their heart and out.
Yes.
I dream to do that for them
yes.
and show them how. And the reason why they were out there, because there was no jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had little education.
No.
And I wanted them off their knees. I wanted them off their knees.
DeCharlene ended up teaching a lot of those prostitutes how to do hair and earn a proper living. Back when crime was more of a problem in the neighborhood, DeCharlene was ready for anyone who tried to attack her.
I used to carry two big guns back in the day. 38 and a long nose and a 38
wow.
snub nose. I used to carry those back in the day. And I carried them for protection because this was a dangerous area. This was like the drug capital of the world at the time. It was a dangerous area. And I used to run into trouble with guys trying to pull me, make me a prostitute or trying to kidnap me, so I just carried my two guns.
One time a man was following her in a car. She had two guns, and the closest place and the safest place she could go to for help was a Seattle Post Intelligencer.
You don't know why everybody's after you.
Right.
And seeing I was married at the time, I was getting rid of my husband, and he had put a crew of people on me because
mm-hmm.
he's the type that he can quit you, but you can't quit him.
Mm-hmm.
He was an older man, and I found out he was a gambler, and he wasn't the man I thought he was. He's supposed to have been a rich man with money. He didn't have anything. He was after what I had. And I found all that out. So he had these crew of people on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started off from work and from my house, and then I hit the freeway. I was following me. I hit the freeway, and then I jumped out of my car, and then that person was following me, and I ran into the P.I. to ask for help, and I got stammered and started studying, and I just started shooting.
Wow.
And everybody called for them to call the police, and they did. And this one policeman, he came and arrested me. And he said that he had dreamed about me the night before. And I had dreamed about him, saw him in my dream. He had blonde hair like mine, curly, and he held out his hand for me to come to him. He was a born-again Christian. And I went to him, and he told me, you come with me. He said, you look real classy. What's going on here? He said, I'm going to help you. He said, stay right with me. He said, I'm going to protect you. And he did that.
Dee Charlene ran for city council. She created the Central Area Chamber of Commerce, and she played a role in creating Medic One. The program was the first in the country that trained firefighters and paramedics to provide care like doctors in the field. Dee Charlene did the hair of the doctors' wives who were starting Medic One. She loved the idea, so she organized a fundraiser fashion show at the University of Washington.
And so my girls, we came out with body jewelry. They had body jewelry, and I had them with thin net stockings on and body jewelry all over them, sent them out. And we was at the hub over here at the University of Washington. And the white people were shocked because they'd never seen that. All black models.
Yes.
Black modeling troop. All black models, and they were shocked. Sharp as a tack. Mm-hmm. And I told all the guys, I says, okay, now, fellas, get your checkbooks out and write us some real money. We're trying to get this project into work. And they said, great. And they just looked and said, yeah, how much should you? What's your? I said, what you can afford and what you cannot afford.
Right.
Put it down there. And they wrote it out, and we got the first wagon started.
What do you love about your work, and what do you love about doing here?
I love it all. And I just love making my dream, like I told you, is make all women beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I like to look at the hair and see what the person needs and grow her hair. And that's how I stay there and take good care of it. And I don't take risks with the hair. And I love it. I love my work because I meet new people. I meet new, exciting people that come into my salon. New, exciting people. Mm-hmm. And they have something to offer. And they appreciate the work you do, and they say, oh, you did this, you did that. Oh, I'm so beautiful, I'm this and that. And then they see you years later, and oh, you remember when you did this for me, you did that? Oh, I love it. See, and that makes me feel good.
Dee Charlene doesn't have any plans to retire soon, and she doesn't plan on selling her building. I think Dee Charlene has an amazing story. I don't know if she knows how amazing and how empowering her story could be for so many people. And I think that's what surprised me the most. I think she needs to write a book. I think that more people need to hear her story, even talking about, you know, the future of the salon and if she has plans to give it to a museum. I mean, it's like being in a time capsule in there. I think that she has so much to give back to the community, and I hope that she knows that she's an amazing, empowering woman.
That story from Hella Black, Hella Seattle co-host Jasmine Jackson. This is Sound Effect, and we continue with some highlights from the first half of 2017. The next story you're about to hear is another one from our Suite 100 episode. All the stories came from office suites with the same address, 100. If you drive south on I-5 from Tacoma near Lakewood, just off to the right, there's a two-story office building, and you could probably whiz by 100 times and never notice. To enter the Suite 100 at 9500 Front Street, you have to go to the back of the building. The name on the door? Tacoma Treatment Solutions. It doesn't really give away what the place does. The name doesn't convey how important it is to the 400 people who come here every day. We sent 88.5's Paula Whistle to check it out.
I'm here a little after 7 in the morning on a Tuesday, and for the past 2 hours, a steady stream of clients have been coming and going. It's a real cross-section. I see several young women in jeans. Others seem to be dressed for the office. There are a few guys in baseball caps.
Still raining out there?
And there's an elderly gentleman going through the door who uses a walker.
Am I right in your way?
Yes.
What they have in common is they're all here to get their daily dose of methadone.
Okay, you're good.
Great. Yep.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Everyone here is addicted to either heroin or prescription pain meds. Methadone, which is also an opioid, helps them get off those drugs. People drive from all over, Olympia, Gig Harbor, just to get their methadone. It comes in liquid form, which you drink out of a paper cup. Most clients are only here for about 10 minutes. They come, take their medication, then in many cases head off to work. The most difficult part of recovery is walking through the door for the first time.
My name's Taylor, and I'm 44 years old, and I've been coming here for, in April, it will be 2 years.
Taylor, which isn't her actual name, she asked that we protect her identity, could easily be mistaken for staff. Fashionably dressed, her shoulder-length dark hair well-groomed, she holds a Starbucks coffee cup while we chat. Her journey into opioid addiction began like it does for so many, with an injury, in her case, a car accident, and pain medication prescribed by her doctor.
I ended up with a broken foot and a broken ankle, and, you know, here it was, using them for, you know, a legitimate reason, and pretty soon it starts to become something to make it easier to deal with the world.
Things started to fall apart. Taylor, who was working, going to school, and dealing with being a single parent, ended up declaring bankruptcy because she had so many medical bills. As a result, she lost her doctor and her access to pain meds. It was a tipping point. The moment when she went from using legally prescribed drugs to ones that came from the street.
I was like, what the heck am I going to do? And somebody says, oh, I know somebody, and they actually have some medication, and they'll sell it to you. And I didn't ask questions why they were selling them. I had no clue. It wasn't my business, or so I thought. It just, so many stresses in your life, it gets easier to, oh, I don't have to deal with that. I can just stuff it down. You take another pill, and it's like, I'm not anxious. Okay, I can deal with that. I wasn't one of those people that just took it and nodded out and did nothing with my life. I mean, I was going to school 21 credits. I was working a full-time job. I had being a single mom, and I took care of my parents who were disabled. And, you know, all of these things just kept coming, and there was no time, you know, to just stop and really deal with myself. I felt like one of these days my number's going to be up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what if I get caught getting this from somebody? What's going to happen then? Then you're really going to lose your home and your kids and your car and your career. And I really didn't want to lose all of that. Who wants to look in the mirror and go, I'm living a lie? Is that the person I really want my kids to see? Is that the person I want to become? Because maybe I'm fine now and I have all these things, but I'm sure the person on the street who has a problem with heroin once upon a time thought the same thing. And I just didn't want to be that kind of statistic.
Things became urgent after she lost several friends to drugs, suicide, and overdoses. An online search for help brought her here to Tacoma Treatment Solutions.
And I was terrified to come in here, truthfully. I was like, these people are going to judge me. You know, I'm used to people looking up to me, and now I'm going to have to be weak and admit that there's something wrong here. And I was so lucky that the person who worked at the front desk, the receptionist, she took me back and she talked to me. And at that point in time, my heart was so heavy that I just kind of threw this all up onto her. And amazingly, she didn't look at me like it was a piece of garbage. And she said, you know, this is what we do, and I think it can help you.
What they did was provide counseling, group therapy, and, of course, a daily dose of methadone overseen by medical professionals.
My name is Dr. Gregory Parada. I am the medical director here at Tacoma Treatment Solutions. And with regards to what methadone does to your body compared to, say, heroin or other things, I think there's a lot of misconception out in the community about what that is. people tend to think like we're just kind of replacing one thing for another, or you know, how is that not like using? But addiction itself actually has more to do with everything around, like what happens around the heroin use, like when you're lying, cheating, stealing, having to do what you need to do to get that, the drive that the high produces and the avoidance of withdrawal. Those things are very powerful, and they make good people do things that they would normally not do. So what the methadone does is it replaces that craving for it in a way that does not produce the high anymore. That just kind of keeps them even, keeps their brain receptors covered, and they don't get high, they don't go through withdrawal.
But isn't the high kind of what you're addicted to? So if you take the high away, do you still have a desire for the heroin?
After a while, for most opiate, I would say actually for almost all opiate addicts, it's more about avoiding the withdrawal. The withdrawal can be very powerful. It basically is like the worst flu you ever had, combining that with diarrhea, vomiting. But it's like that, but 10 times worse.
He says it's up to the patient to decide if they'll stay on methadone long term or get weaned off of it. For Taylor, the choice for now is to remain on methadone indefinitely.
The nice thing is you take it and it's almost kind of like set it and forget it. You don't. The nice thing is not being obsessed or thinking about that.
There aren't too many clinics like this around. Communities tend to fight methadone clinics, concerned about the clientele they'll attract. In fact, there are only two in all of Pierce County. When Taylor first started coming here, she drove 40 miles each way every single day to get her methadone.
I would try to get here in between 5 and 5:30.
In the morning?
Yes, in the morning. And so that would require getting up at about 3:30, getting ready, preparing everybody's stuff to get out the door, and then, of course, the traffic to get here, which can be sometimes pretty crazy out there. I kind of had to learn to kind of get all of my ducks in row.
Now, after 2 years, she doesn't have to come as often. She's given a 2-week supply of methadone that she keeps at home in a safe and doles out on her own. As for if she worries about slipping back into her old ways, she says all she has to do is think of her 6 children.
I just couldn't imagine having my kids go, "My mom died from an accidental overdose." I mean, how sad is that?
Taylor says this is something she's committed to for the long haul. The treatment costs her about $430 out of her own pocket each month, but she says it's worth it. It's a long-term investment she's willing to make.
That story from 88.5's Paula Whistle. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and on today's episode, we've been playing some of our favorite stories from the first 6 months of this year. And it is really hard to believe that we're already 6 months into 2017. Since the beginning of time, people have been taking huge risks for the things that they love and believe in. Sound Effect contributor Heba Fisher tells us about one man's journey from the war in Yemen to Seattle to tell the world about really good coffee that goes for $16 a cup.
We're here tasting some beautiful coffees.
This is 28-year-old Yemeni-American Mokhtar Al-Khanshari.
This is called a coffee cup-in or taste-in.
He loves coffee. He's the first Arab-certified Q grader, the coffee equivalent of a sommelier for wine. And he's the type of man to randomly recite Arabic poetry about coffee. In early April 2015, the Specialty Coffee Association of America hosted an event here in Seattle for buyers from all across the country to sample new coffees. Mokhtar was eager for this event. He had been working towards it for over a year with coffee farmers on the ground in Yemen to get their coffee to a quality he could debut at the Seattle event. So here was the plan. He was going to fly out from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, to Seattle for the event. But then, the world as he knew it changed.
2 days before I was supposed to leave, I remember I woke up and thought it was a wedding next nearby at first. There were anti-aircraft machine guns. This was when the war began.
The UN envoy warning that Yemen is at, quote, the edge of civil war.
But before we get to the war, let's start at the beginning. Mukhtar grew up between the United States and Yemen. At his grandparents' house in Yemen, he remembers his first introduction to coffee, picking the red coffee berries with his grandmother off the dozens of trees in their garden. Years later, something triggered in Mukhtar's mind to revive Yemeni coffee for global markets. And I say revive because while the first coffee berry was discovered in Ethiopia, the art of brewing coffee, as we know it today, originated in Yemen.
In Yemen, there's all these varietals that grow there that nowhere else in the world has. You know, it's amazing the amount of diversity in genetics there.
So at the end of 2013, Mukhtar went to Yemen to visit different coffee farms, just to see, was the coffee he'd find at a quality he could export to the rest of the world?
I ended up going to 32 different regions in Yemen that grew coffee, 1,000-year-old villages, and the people have been living the same way for generations. Just for a moment, time stops. Every time I would go somewhere, I'd bring a stack of coffee with me, a sample from the one area. And, you know, it was like a little part of the room. Eventually, I filled up all the room. Like, this one room was full of coffee bags from different areas.
After several months gathering samples, Mukhtar decided to test their quality. Some came back with really high marks.
I'm making them some of the most expensive and rarest coffees ever.
But for the most part, his coffee samples tested all over the place in quality.
So I realized the way it was picked and processed, all these, there was no protocol, there was no system in place. And so the result would always be random.
So Mukhtar realized there was some work to be done. Over the next year and a half, he went back and forth between Yemen and the U.S., training his coffee farmers to get things up to quality. Now, moving forward to 2015, Mukhtar planned to attend that big coffee conference in Seattle. Buyers from all over the country would be there to sample his coffee. And that's when, 2 days before Mukhtar was set to fly out of Yemen to attend the conference here in Seattle, the Yemeni war began.
We just woke up and the war began and there was airstrikes and they bombed both airports. They bombed both ports, so we couldn't leave. We tried contacting the State Department. Their official response was, we can't help you, but we can relay your message to your loved ones via our website. It was like a scary, realization not to know if you were going to live to see the morning. I remember being afraid of that. It was the first time I really felt afraid. And then so the morning I was, okay, I have to leave. Next day, I went to Mocha, a 7-hour drive.
Mocha is a city in the southwest coast of Yemen.
It's a small little port, no one uses it anymore. It was the first port in the world to commercialize coffee, and that's where the name Mocha comes from, coffee. So I went there, and we were supposed to take a small ship with like 100 passengers from Somalia. The ship wasn't working, there was no diesel, there was airstrikes, and said, instead of a 3-day journey across the Red Sea, you can take a smaller ship. It's like a boat, and it's called a Viper, and it's 1 day only to cross. So I'm like, all right. In my mind, I'm like a Viper. I mean, like a Dodge Viper, like a fast thing, you know. And he meant fiber, like fiberglass. So we get there, and it was like this little boat dinghy. You know, no one leaves land, go on ocean, unless they have no other choice. And I remember the first thing I asked the guy when he was taking me, I was like, I want my coffee samples. So he gave me like my bag that I had. It's like I had a Samsonite bag with coffee samples in it. I still remember, you know, texting my brother and telling him to my mom and dad I love them. Before I left in the boat. You know, you're in this giant ocean, it's like these waves crashing on you, and this guy has no like GPS, you don't know, he knows where he's going, you know, and he has one single motor engine. If it dies, you're done, you're stuck. You know, we don't even have any food. And so I didn't think of anything, I just thought about like my mother and my father. And seeing them. And then we made it eventually to Djibouti, across the Red Sea.
On April 1st, to be sure he made it to the coffee conference in Seattle on the 11th, Mukhtar traveled 100 miles from Mocha in Yemen to Obok in Djibouti in a tiny fiberglass boat across the Red Sea. He arrived in Djibouti on April 3rd, was detained for a day and a half, and managed to fly out to Kenya. From there, Amsterdam, and finally to Mukhtar's hometown of San Francisco. It was April 7th.
I landed, and the next day I made it to Seattle.
He made it, with time to prep for the event on the 11th.
I had the coffee roasted for the event, got to the conference, these tables set up all over this giant room, and it was the most well-attended coffee tasting in the history of that conference.
What were you thinking while you were there? Were you nervous beforehand?
No, I wasn't nervous. I mean, I hadn't processed anything yet. I was still in shock, but I wanted to finish this conference and do well in it. It was like six different tables in the same set, and each table was the best cup every table. It had a really explosive taste to it right away. Before you even sip, you can smell like the fruitiness, notes on it. Papaya, mango, and it was amazing. Strawberries, you know, it was great. It was great coffee. There was a French guy called it my coffee celestial. So I don't know what that means, but all these buyers were there, and it was like, I mean, the price points people were giving me was great. And then
what were some of the price points?
The highest that people ever paid for coffee.
To give you an idea, his coffee sells for $16 a cup of black coffee at Blue Bottle. Since Mukhtar made it to that buying event, it's like the floodgates have opened for him and his coffee brand, Port of Mocha Coffee.
The Blue Bottle sold out within less than 2 months. Our next shipment, it's going to be here in like less than 2 weeks now, and it's going to Slate in Seattle, Quatum in France, in Switzerland, in Asia. Some of the best coffee shops in the world.
Since 2015, Mukhtar has gone back to Yemen and is planning more trips. Most of his family living in Yemen has since left. The Yemeni war is still raging on, making it really difficult to grow and export anything, let alone coffee. But his team is managing, and he's able to pay his farmers some of the highest wages even during the war, and every cup of Port of Mocha coffee ordered comes with Mukhtar's story and the story of Yemen's history in coffee.
My goal is to impact this country in Yemen with coffee and to impact people here with hearing or learning about Yemen, about Arabs, about Muslims in a very positive way, and this coffee is just this great medium. No one cares about politics, but they love coffee, so it's a way for them to learn about us in a nicer way.
That was sound effect contributor Heba Fisher. That story was from an episode we did called It's About Time. And you can find links to the story and all the others that you heard on today's show. Just go to our website, knkx.org. That does it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. We get help this week from Ed Ronco, Jasmine Jackson, Paula Whistle, Heba Fisher. Dave Nagaris takes care of us online. Parker Miles Blom helps out with photos and videos. And Erin Hennessy, she is our executive producer. Next week on Sound Effect, it's the things that keep us up at night.
I get kind of congested and have trouble breathing, and start to fall asleep and start to have a dream where I'm not able to get enough air. And it's so horrible and nightmarish that it will wake me up.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.